talking about clauses that can cause problems today on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the organization, the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, prepping, as I can hear as he's flipping pages, is our Vice Chairman, Constitutional Teacher, all-around great guy, technical expert, and a historian, Chuck Michaels.
I was prepping, but I was getting a drink of water.
As because, you can tell, ladies and gentlemen, we are in our remote location. Charles is probably firmly ensconced in his library, which we call the North Library of the Institute. And I'm in the South Library today. So.
Yep, I'm coming to you by the miracle of Skype. Truly a modern technology that simply can't be beat for people that live 120 miles apart.
But as Chuck and I were talking, and as we were discussing the very issues we've been discussing over the last week on the program, we both, and in looking in the news and the headlines and trying to do some forecasting, we realized that probably what's going to end up happening, as most of you know, this week there was an announcement made that the United States Supreme Court will take up for review cases relating to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, that they have actually scheduled arguments on some of the cases that they've accepted for review for, I believe, March of 2012. As you know, the court's calendar runs, I believe, through June, and then they're off until October. But they are going to hear arguments on some of the cases challenging the constitutionality of the congressionally passed act known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. If you're familiar with this program, you realize that I am trying very diligently not to call that particular piece of legislation a law, because it's not truly a law. However, we're going to be discussing some clauses in the United States Constitution today that have been used, are being used, and may be used by the United States Supreme Court to try to get around that little problem. Chuck, I'm going to let you kind of run with this today, because you know this was kind of your musings and thoughts as we were having our discussions, and I just want you to kind of flesh it out for me.
Okay, well, the first thing I want to talk about today is the very fact that many of you are maybe on emailing lists, and you will get emails that maybe alert you to things that are going on. And when this announcement came out that the Supreme Court had agreed, quote unquote, agreed to hear the Obamacare case, I remember reading that too. And first thing I did was I kind of laughed, but it was a sort of an ironic laughter because all the headlines, I mean, I've got three or four, maybe five of these emails, and they all said Supreme Court agrees to hear case on Obamacare. Here are the constitutional facts. Article 3 makes it very clear. The Supreme Court basically, it made it sound like they sort of voluntarily decided to take that case. Well, the fact is, the Supreme Court has no choice. The Supreme Court had to hear the case. And the reason it had to hear the case is because of Article 3, Section 2. One of the important parts of Article 3, Section 2 is this little clause: in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party. What was going on with Obamacare? There are, what, 28 states?
Yes,
suing the federal government?
The state's attorney generals representing each of the states, including our own attorney general, Mike DeWine, who signed on to the case. Those states are suing the federal government over the constitutionality of Obamacare. And Chuck, just to make sure everybody's following along, if you have your pocket constitution, we're talking about Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph number 2. Now, the paragraphs usually in most pocket constitutions are not numbered, but it is the second full paragraph that
right,
Chuck's talking
in Article
about.
Article 2, yeah.
So basically it says, any case, in all cases, now the word all is in here, in all cases affecting ambassadors of the public ministers and councils, and those in which a state shall be party. So in other words, in which a state shall be the party, the Supreme Court shall, and Chuck, what does this say? I want to make sure my constitution, my copy says the same thing yours did.
Well, hopefully they do, or else we're in big trouble.
We've got a problem. Yeah. It says, what kind of jurisdiction should the Supreme Court have in those cases?
It has original jurisdiction, not appellate, original.
I was going to say, let's tell our folks the difference between those two. I'm sure most people understand those differences, but just in case they're wondering if it's some trick of the law or trick of legal language, tell them what the differences are between those two.
In an original jurisdiction case, the only court that is authorized to hear the case is the Supreme Court. In other words, the Supreme Court is the court of refuge, or the court that any case involving those specific cases, it's the only authorized court. It's not the lower federal courts that may be created by Congress. It's not the state courts, concocted international court. The Supreme Court is the court where the case must be heard.
Exactly.
Now, in an appellate jurisdiction, there is a path by which you can go through the lower federal courts, the district and the circuit courts.
Right.
The appeals courts. And in fact, the difference between those two types of cases is that in the original jurisdiction cases, Congress has no ability to limit what the Supreme Court, the cases that the Supreme Court can hear. And that is because those cases are already limited by constitutional authority. They're limited to this list here, cases infecting ambassadors, public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party. Okay. Now, in the appellate jurisdiction, Congress can stop the Supreme Court from hearing cases. That has important implications, and people always laugh at us when we say this, but these are the facts. For instance, Roe v. Wade could very easily be overturned tomorrow by the simple act of Congress passing a law and the president signing it. And I realize that we're now in the realm of fantasy land, but if Congress
are you sure about that part?
Yes. Under perfect conditions, let's put it that way. Congress would pass this law. The president would sign it. And in that law would be a clause that says the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and the lower courts shall not apply in this case. And that is because a state will not be a party to this. Remember, this is a case, this would be between the state and individuals in it, not with the federal government. And therefore, the federal government can simply say, pass a law that says, definition of murder is within the authority of the states because it is not among the enumerated powers, and the appellate jurisdiction of the lower courts and the Supreme Court shall not attach in this case.
Okay. Now, if in case folks think we're talking about some kind of an archaic, rarely used, last dusted off when America was in its cradle, I got news for ladies and gentlemen. We've had Congress limit the jurisdiction of the court to hear cases as late as the late 90s. During the Clinton administration.
I think 95
or
96.
If I remember correctly, it was former... It was 95 or 96.
House Majority
Leader. It was former House Majority Leader.
Tom Daschle.
There, as you said that. Who actually, in a bill, wrote in a clause that basically took away the jurisdiction of the courts to hear any cases involving timber rights in South Dakota. He wanted to keep it in state. So in other words, they basically, and this law passed and it was signed. So now the federal court has no ability to hear any case that is appealed or brought to it that deals with anything dealing with the timber rights in the state of South Dakota. They are absolutely bound not to hear those cases. They can't. They have been limited because that was appellate jurisdiction.
At least until that law sunsets or is repealed.
Exactly. Exactly. It would have to be repealed by Congress. Just in the same way that Congress, as the Constitution says, from time to time can create courts lower than the Supreme Court, they can also, from time to time, as they choose to do so, limit the jurisdiction of those courts. And Chuck, I think that, you know, pointing again as well here, that whole idea of limiting the jurisdiction is found in Article 3, if I remember correctly, even though we're talking about the Congress.
Well, okay, here in the same paragraph, in all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
There it is.
There's the explicit power to ban the Supreme Court from hearing certain kinds of appellate cases. Now, the way the Supreme Court looks at it is, oh, basically, it doesn't matter if that's in there or not. Although I can tell you in the past, this has been used in the 1860s or the late 1800s. I don't know if it was in the 1860s. It was in the late 1800s. There was a case where essentially the Supreme Court was stripped of its appellate jurisdiction. Somebody insisted that it be heard by the court. The court looked at the case, read the law, issued a ruling dismissing the case, in which you could hear in the ruling the judges, through what they had written, citing through gritted teeth the fact that since our appellate jurisdiction in this case has been limited by Congress, we have to say case dismissed. And it wasn't quite that terse, but the fact is, you could tell the justices really wanted to hear the case very badly, mm-hmm. and they were not permitted to do so, and it really stuck in their craws. Because they had by then even come to believe what they believe now, and that is that they are the final arbiters of what the law says, when in fact it's very clear from the Constitution that really they are not the final arbiters. In fact, really the final arbiters are the states and the people, respectively.
So in other words, a true balance, that's a true check on the power of the courts through the elected representatives of the people to keep the courts from becoming super legislatures. Now, we wish we would do more things than just timber rights in South Dakota, maybe to the possibility of if our current Congress really, really, really wanted to do something about this healthcare debacle, possibly they'd just say the courts can hear no cases regarding this.
It won't work in this case, and here's why.
Because
the law that has been passed does what I think it's Medicaid. I always get Medicare and Medicaid mixed up. Which one has been basically put on the backs of the states? It's Medicaid, isn't
Medicaid.
It?
Medicaid's on the states. Medicare is fed.
Because it's been constructed like that, where essentially the federal government has mandated that the states do these things. In other words, the federal government has said the states shall set up these health exchanges and require citizens to obtain some kind of health insurance, either privately or through some kind of a health exchange set up by the states and administered and, of course, paid for by the states. That does not hold. The states then have essentially had their own sovereignty usurped by the federal government. And the reason that they can demand that the Supreme Court hear in their original jurisdiction power is because of that clause. This is not an appellate case. This is an original jurisdiction case in which the state governments are a party suing the federal government. Therefore, this is an original jurisdiction.
Okay, but refresh my memory a little bit on this, Chuck, because I seem to remember that wasn't there a request made or a filing made at the United States Supreme Court by one of the states in relation to this, and the Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear it. You have to take it through the lower courts?
Yes, they completely violated not only the spirit but the letter of the law of the Constitution. And remember, the Constitution, according to Article 6, the highest law of the land, the Supreme Court basically arrogantly declared that they absolutely would not hear a case that didn't come up through the lower courts, something that they are not permitted to do.
Now, wait, but the ones who could stop them from doing it, because obviously they did it, Obviously, they pressed that and required the states or their representatives through their attorneys general to actually have to spend much more time, effort, resources, taxpayer dollars to do something that the Constitution binds the Supreme Court to do. How did they get away with that?
Well, they got away with it because John Boehner, who essentially has the authority to begin impeachment hearings, did nothing. The Congress allowed the Supreme Court to disobey the law by doing nothing. In fact, what should have happened was the state attorney general should have all 28 state attorney generals should have got together, put their heads together, had a big meeting and said, gone to Congress and said, okay, they are now in violation of the law. We want impeachment. We want either a resolution passed immediately or we want impeachment hearings against these sitting members of the Supreme Court who voted not to hear these cases on the basis that the law is clear. They can't refuse to hear the cases.
Right. But they did. And so our Congress, our congressional leaders are basically either asleep at the switch, derelict in their duties, or are standing in need of impeachment themselves for not upholding their oath of office. Would you not concur in that?
Oh, absolutely. Look, the federal government overtly and regularly ignores the Constitution. One of the reasons that we teach our Institute on the Constitution class, that's brought to you by the Institute on the Constitution out of Maryland, the reason we teach that class is to get people familiar with the idea that there really is a law, they really do have to obey it, and the Constitution doesn't just say the federal government has all power and they can do whatever they want. That is an idea that has come up really in the last, 80 years or so since the Great Depression. Before that time, people in the federal government who attempted to usurp authority would be regularly smacked down, although it goes back a little further than that, probably to around the time of the war between the states, really. We're not going to get into this today, but the real question is and always has been, do the states have the legal right to nullify and secede? And the answer is, if you think about it in these terms, that in fact secession has been used twice in our history, successfully and one time unsuccessfully. The first time was when we seceded from the Union of Great Britain and the United Colonies. And the second time was when the states who were members of the Union under the Articles of Confederation seceded from that Union and formed a new one under the Constitution. The third attempt was made by the southern states who tried to leave the Union and were stopped by force. So it's got a 2-1 score, but nobody wants to think about it in those terms. So the answer is the Constitution gets ignored all the time, and the voters really have been dumbed down by public education. I remember taking POD, Problems of Democracy, when in fact I knew full well we lived in a republic.
Well, that's the biggest problem right there. We're not a democracy.
Right. And the idea then was being pushed on us with that title was that if the people wanted the Supreme or the federal government to be supreme, then therefore they were, because after all, the people were the supreme law of the land. Well, the people's will is the supreme law of the land within the limits of law. And that is the difference between a republic and a democracy. Government's power is limited by law in a republic. The people's will rules supremely in a democracy. And that's why a lynch mob is a perfect example of a democracy. The vote very often was 50-1 in favor of hanging the perpetrator after a kangaroo court. Well, guess who the one vote against was? Was the guy getting his neck stretched?
Well, I was going to say it would probably be the person who would lose the most by the vote going the wrong way.
Yeah. So what's going on here is essentially we have a lawless lawmaking apparatus right now. We have a law that everyone ignores. Let's take, for instance, the fact that the Supreme Court, over a century, has essentially used clauses in the Constitution that it were put in there to actually protect the states and their sovereignty, to strip the states of their sovereignty. For instance, the Interstate Commerce Clause, as it's been shortened to the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause, the very reason that we have a constitution, rather than still operating under the Articles of Confederation, was the fact that the Articles didn't have a Commerce Clause. At the time, and if you read anything having to do with the Constitution and how it was written and the reasons it was written, everybody knew at the time what commerce meant. It meant trade. The trade between the states was limited by the fact that every one of them was operating from an attitude of complete sovereignty. Let's say Philadelphia had a great port.
Mm-hmm.
And right across the river in New Jersey, they didn't. They needed to bring in the stuff into the port of Philadelphia and transport it to New Jersey. Well, guess what? There was very often an export and import duties at the border between Pennsylvania and New Jersey because they were sovereign states. And Pennsylvania was not going to give up the revenue that they were taking in by collecting these duties on these things that were imported into Philadelphia and then hauled across the river by wagon into New Jersey. And New Jersey had the same problem with New York on the eastern end. Things would come into the port of New York, have to be hauled into New Jersey, and there might be a duty. So what was happening was the states that had great harbors were kind of lording it over the states who had no harbors. Or had no border on an ocean, or were far away from a border on an ocean, or a river port, or whatever. So mm-hmm. What was happening was it was creating a horrible trade imbalance between the states. States like New York and Virginia and you know, Pennsylvania were getting rich, gouging places like New Hampshire and you know some of the interior states, gouging horribly for trade, you know, for export and import of goods.
So in other words, what you're saying is that they didn't extend most favored nation status and waive all of the duties and imposts and tariffs. So what, you know, what you mean we could have just stuck with the Articles of Confederation had they just done what our current Congress does and give foreign countries free access to our ports?
Well, what was really happening was that they were treating one another as foreign nations.
Right.
The sovereignty of the individual states had sort of run amok at that point. And almost everybody agreed, anyone who was thinking about these problems and the fact and the wedge it was driving between the states, these sovereign entities, realized that something had to be done about interstate commerce. Without going into great detail, there were several attempts to fix the Commerce Clause that simply failed. And so finally, not many people realized this, but the reason the Constitutional Convention got called in 1787 was to fix the Interstate Commerce Clause. And that was all it was really. It was supposed to be a limited convention for the purpose of fixing the Interstate Commerce Clause, for adding one to the Articles of Confederation and maybe making a few tweaks here and there for some other things. But the main idea was the excuse, the Interstate Commerce Clause. So that's the reason there is one in the current Constitution. Well, that has been twisted almost beyond belief. Now, basically, anything that could have any effect on anything going on, let's put it this way. It doesn't even have to be interstate anymore. It can be intrastate, and it still, quote-unquote, affects interstate commerce. Now, the original understanding, if you read, for instance, let me pop up something here.
Okay.
And give me a minute. I will read from Federalist Number 33.
Okay. These are the Federalist Papers, ladies and gentlemen, that were penned by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, very easily to obtain just about any bookstore, you'll find a copy of the Federalist Papers. They're numbered. There are 85 of the papers that were written. These were short articles. Well, they're not very short. Some of them are very long articles. that were written in the newspapers of the state of New York during the time that New York was going to be, their convention was going to be meeting to decide whether or not to ratify the new Constitution. And so Hamilton, Madison, and Jay moved forward to write a defense of the new Constitution and the reasons why it was much superior to the existing Articles of Confederation.
Now, what this section is on is actually on the Supremacy Clause, but it also delves into this idea, and this shows you how the Supremacy Clause, the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, all these problematic clauses fit together like puzzle pieces. Now, this is an attempt, and I'm not mistaken, I forget who wrote number 33. I think this is Madison.
Okay.
And I can look that up later and we can figure that out. But if a number of political societies enter into a larger political society, that's okay, the states banding together into a larger political society, the laws which the latter may enact pursuant to the powers entrusted to it by its constitution must necessarily be supreme over those societies. Okay, so far that makes sense. Otherwise, you get sovereignty run amok. And the individuals of whom they are composed, it would otherwise be a mere treaty dependent on the good faith of the parties and not a government, which is only another word for political power and supremacy. But it will not follow from this doctrine that acts of the large society which are not pursuant to its constitutional powers, very important, not pursuant to its constitutional powers, but which are invasions of the residuary authorities of the smaller societies, will become the supreme law of the land. These will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such. Hence we perceive that the clause which declares the supremacy of the laws of the Union, like the one we have just before considered, only declares a truth which flows immediately and necessarily from the institution of a federal government. It will not, I presume, have escaped observation that it expressly confines this supremacy to laws made pursuant to the Constitution, which I mention merely as an instance of caution in the convention, since that limitation would have been to be understood, though it had not been expressed. Right there in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen, is why when you hear arguments that such clauses as the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Welfare Clause, the Supremacy Clause mean the federal government can do anything it wants to, are simply bogus claims of people who are attempting to usurp state, local, personal liberty to themselves. They are arrogating power to themselves.
Now, I have a surprise for you, Chuck. Looked it up. The person who was worried about the grandiose extension of federal power by these clauses,
Hamilton,
was Alexander Hamilton, okay, who wrote Federalist Number 33, and he wrote it in the Independent Journal, which was a New York State paper, on Wednesday, January the 2nd of 1788. This is actually 33 was a continuation from the previous one. He wrote four articles in a row on the general subject of the general power of taxation. Now, I wonder why Hamilton would have been concerned about taxation and writing about the Supremacy Clause. It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
And the gist of the article when you read it is basically that the taxation power is limited.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Now, we've quoted a number of clauses here. I just want to make sure, for the benefit of our listeners, that we point out to them where these clauses rest in the document so that they can read them in context for themselves. So the Supremacy Clause, which we've talked about on this program before, is Article 6, the second paragraph, which says this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So that's the Supremacy Clause. That's Article 6, second paragraph. Now, you were also looking up, and you had mentioned some other clauses. We have the Necessary and Proper Clause. Article 1, Section 8,
last paragraph. Article 1, Section 8, last paragraph. The very last paragraph. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof.
Now that it's interesting there, Chuck, because number one, you know, any department or officer thereof, in other words, you can't have any individual who is a cabinet secretary or czar of any shape or form who can basically say, hey, stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool, huh? Because it's not true unless it's made, as it says, that powers vested by this Constitution.
That's
in other
right.
words, that's limited authority, limited powers, enumerated powers, both on the a legislative, where this falls in Article 1, Section 8, and on the executive branch, because that's the department or officer thereof section.
That's right. And that word vested is a very important word, because what it says is that power comes from someplace. We know where the powers come from by looking at the 10th Amendment.
Aha. So, yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are doing constitutional calisthenics today. You're jumping back and forth, but you do this for a reason, because it's the document that governs our country. We, as patriotic American Christian citizens, ought to know it, and ought to know it well enough to know where to find things in it. So you were saying 10th Amendment, Chuck.
10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. And there, remember that Article 1, Section 9, and there's a couple other places, denies certain powers to the states.
To the states, that's right.
And that is to protect the sovereign realm of the federal government. Remember, that's that phrase that we always like to throw around, DDT. Defense, diplomacy, and trade. Every power that is handed to the federal government and denied to the states specifically has to do with defense, diplomacy, or trade. And that trade being equal to and synonymous with commerce. Okay, back to this. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The gist of that is, of course, that if the power is not specifically delegated to the federal government, or shall we say vested in the Congress, because Congress is where...
Yes, we shall say that.
That's right. Congress, those powers are vested in a Congress, because that's where the laws are made, not in the executive branch by executive authority or an executive order. They are in the hands of the legislature. We know this to be true because of Article 10 or the 10th Amendment. There simply can be no doubt about that. And the fact that they are specifically enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. You know, why would you need to enumerate these powers if this is merely a suggestion of possible powers that you might consider to be of the federal government? Anything that might affect something that might go on between states is automatically interstate commerce? No, that's not what was meant by that, as we explained earlier. And you cannot abuse that clause or that supremacy clause to make the Constitution say something which it does not. Oliver Wendell Holmes was sort of infamous for twisting these clauses. And one of the clauses that they love to twist is the General Welfare Clause.
Aha, the General Welfare Clause. Where are we at now in our constitutional calisthenics?
Well, let's see. I believe this is also Article 1, Section 8. basically the general welfare clause. It's mentioned in the preamble, but people that always want to make the preamble mean something that it does not. The preamble is a philosophical statement of what's going on in the Constitution. The real preamble, it's sort of a very shortened version of the real preamble, which is the Declaration of Independence.
That's right.
And we talked about that in our first series of shows. And if those are now no longer available, I think if you haven't signed up for iTunes, they're not on the queue. We can make those available to the folks out there if they want. Just send us a note and we'll tell you how to get a CD with those opening shows on them on the Declaration of Independence.
Exactly.
But go to principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And send us an email. Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Now, a lot of people are saying, like, okay, what's this big deal about this thing about being uniform throughout the United States? Aha! That points back to the argument we just made about the reason that the Interstate Commerce Clause is in the Constitution. And that was the fact that duties, imposts, and excises were all over the place.
Exactly.
They were all over the place, and in fact, it became a matter of quote-unquote competition. The way you see kind of states now bribing companies to come in to the state by giving them unbelievably stupid tax incentives to come here. You know, come here, you won't have to pay any income tax, and we'll no corporate income tax or no corporate property taxes for 25 years as long as you bring in X number of workers that we can gouge for an income tax. You know, this kind of thing went on in the form of duties, imposts, excises between states. And in fact, some companies would be given kickbacks to come into one port and not another one in another state, that kind of thing. And so this points to the fact that this is an argument in favor of our position. Now, that general welfare thing, what was meant by that? A lot of people point to that and say, see, welfare was supposed to be part of the Constitution. Welfare has a lot of meanings. And in the 18th century, the end of the 18th century when this was written, the meaning that it had was, especially with the word general appended to the front of it, this was the welfare of the states. In other words, their ability to conduct trade not only interstate, but internationally. One has to remember that the United States was founded as a commercial republic. The United States was founded on the idea of commerce, trade, and free market. And really what was going on with the Interstate Commerce Clause was the federal government formed what today would be called a 13-state free trade zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was to enable farmers and manufacturers. And now, the United States didn't have much manufacturing when it started. But it did within 25 years of when it started. We started doing major manufacturing. And that was because our ports were free from the kind of backbiting and infighting that comes from competition between states that have decent ports and states that don't. This way, states like New Jersey could ship their goods to Philadelphia and have it go out without recourse to, you know, having to pay some kind of a duty between on the border with Pennsylvania. So the general welfare idea was essentially to make it so the states could engage in these trade practices.
You know, Chuck, I always think it's instructive, especially when we're dealing with the Constitution and these words, not to put our 21st century postmodern anything goes definitions and assume that that's what our founders meant. We need to go back and look at these words in the context of the time period they were in. And the best way to do that, you and I have teach this in the class, is to go to one of the founders themselves, Noah Webster, the father of the dictionary in English, whose 1828 Webster's Dictionary, the original dictionary of the American English language, has the definitions of the words as they were commonly understood by our founders, his contemporaries. And you're right about that general welfare clause, because welfare, by the 1828 Webster Dictionary definition, especially that general welfare, because there's particular welfare which is applied to persons, and general, which is, as it says in the definition, applied to states. It says this is what it means. It means exemption from any unusual evil or calamity, the enjoyment of peace and prosperity, or the ordinary blessings of society and civil government applied to states. That's what the term welfare means, how the founders used it in the document, in the Constitution. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm looking at my copy, which tries to take pains to utilize the grammatical style that was the founder's style during that time period, where the word general is lowercase, but the word welfare is capitalized, because that had import. They wanted to make a specific point about that, and the specific point was Webster's definition.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's interesting that Federalist 32 gives a kind of a long dissertation on the general welfare, and we won't go into that, but it might be instructive for people who want to read that to go about and read, get a copy of the Federalist Papers, folks. Here in Columbus, we have I think, 5 locations of Half-Price Books. I can go there tomorrow and probably find 3 different editions of the Federalist.
Indeed.
You can find them in all kinds of conditions, softback, paperback. You can find some with commentary. You can find what I would avoid is certain modernized versions. Look, folks, the language is a little stilted. It was written in the 18th century. I'll agree with you. But one thing to remember about the Federalist Papers, and also about the Anti-Federalist, and please do not neglect the Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists showed us one of the great things about the Anti-Federalists. Well, I'll come back to that. Go to Half-Price Books. Go to a used bookstore. They're all over the place. Find a copy of the Federalist, buy a new copy, go to Barnes & Noble, go to whatever your local bookseller is.
Or, if I may suggest, go to principledpolicy.com to our Amazon bookstore and order it there.
Please do so. Go to our Amazon store and order a copy. You can even find it online and read it if you want to. Read it for free for what you lay out every month for your internet connection. But read these things. And we do a low-priced class on the Constitution, and some of the things you will be lectured on is what is contained in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers. And we would invite everybody, come out to principledpolicy.com and send us a note where you'd like a class taught. You know, Barry's doing them in Southeast Ohio and South Central Ohio. He's signed up people for classes. I've done them in Central Ohio. We would love to teach you these things. We would love to get a chance to familiarize you with these issues.
Okay, we're back to the general welfare clause.
Well, essentially, one must remember that what we talk about when we talk about welfare today, the general use of the term welfare, we're talking about what would be known as not the general welfare, but the specific welfare. And
correct.
By that we mean that we are providing a living, health care, jobs, whatever, to individuals. That is not the general welfare. That is specific welfare. That is not within the powers of the federal government. They are not contained in the enumerated powers. And the fact that there's a phrase in Article 1, Section 8 pertaining to the general welfare, the meaning of that becomes clear when you read the commentaries written by the men who wrote it. So please do not get hoodwinked into thinking that the general welfare somehow means the specific welfare of welfare recipients. It doesn't and never has. Okay, really, one of the we've got about 10 minutes left, and the last thing I really want to get into is the necessary and proper clause. Because the necessary and proper clause, we kind of skimmed over it earlier, but it has really been abused. Yes. It has really been abused in combination with the general welfare clause and in combination with the interstate commerce clause. It basically, even conservative modern Supreme Court justices like Antonin Scalia have made statements that can only be deemed as dangerously circular insofar as they make the assumption that the federal government has the power when the they make the laws, has stated that basically in combination, the interstate commerce clause with the necessary and proper clause means that the federal government can do almost anything. Believe me, the original intent was to restrict the power of the federal government, not hand it carte blanche to do anything that it wanted. The necessary and proper clause refers back directly to the fact that there are certain specific enumerated powers and that those powers are limited, not to the fact that the government can do anything it wants in the guise of complying with the general welfare, the interstate commerce, or the supremacy clause. So essentially, the idea that those combinations of clauses out of their context mean that the federal government can do anything is simply it's sophistry. It's basically saying
But the courts and Congress have made that a reason for being for so long that I guess they think that people are not going to see it as sophistry. They're just going to see it as, well, we're just stating the facts.
Well, again, let's go back to public education.
What
does everybody learn in classes like POD, Problems of Democracy, as we mentioned earlier? They learn that essentially the federal government has the right to do anything. Nobody really learns the mechanics of the Constitution. They simply learn that there are certain words in there, and here's what the Supreme Court says. The reason that the courts have been made into the final arbiter, again, is because people don't understand what their function is and what the limits of their power is. We have to get back to an understanding of the limits on the authority of the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and especially right now of the executive branch, because the executive branch is simply being allowed to run hog wild. I've never liked the idea of these quote-unquote czars who are basically these guys who are given authority over multiple agencies and who are really just simply appointed by the president and don't have to go through the vetting process, if I'm not mistaken. They don't have to go through a confirmation by Congress because they don't specifically head up a cabinet position. They are a direct advisor to the president.
Mm-hmm, that's
and
right.
He has handed over authority to them to oversee agencies which have supposedly similar or common goals in mind. Well, the real question comes to mind is why are there all of this alphabet soup of agencies out there that have similar purposes in mind and have multiple bureaucracies that could easily be combined into single departments or have their powers restricted back to their constitutional limit.
Well, Chuck, there is a reason for that. And it's a fairly simple reason. If you have a multitude of agencies, then you have places to put supporters, campaign workers, people who give big donations to your campaign or to the parties. You can put people who are part of your long-term agenda into positions where they can change things and move levers and be your voice for your agenda and make it look like it's an independent voice coming out. This is an old game. that we expand government, we expand the agencies, we never contract them. You know, they can talk all they want to, and Rick Perry can have his, you know, 52 seconds of silence because he couldn't remember the Department of Energy. But the point is, the organizations like the EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, and many others, Department of Homeland Security, by the way, are illegitimate agencies. Those functions could have easily been done by the basic agencies that we have, from the Department of State, the Department of the Interior, you know, Homeland Security. What happened to the Department of the Interior? And even that is a question of whether or not we even need that agency. But the point is that the more agencies you have, then the more power and the more force you can bring as an executive against Congress by just constantly wearing them out, by sending different agencies in with different ideas or coming into a congressional idea that may say, well, we're going to cut this agency's budget. Well, we've got all this coordination going on, and this agency and that agency and that agency, they all have a part of this. And if you hurt one, you're going to hurt them all. It's a way to circle the wagons. That basically pure and simple. And it gets back to what our founder said in the true preamble to the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, as one of their main reasons for the separation. And that is that at that point, the king had been doing things, as they said, let's see, how did they put it? Oh, yes, that he would send forth basically bureaucrats. And I'm going to read it. And he has erected a multitude of new offices. Sound familiar? And sent hither swarms of officers, think czars, to harass our people and eat out their substance. The more agencies we have, the more tax dollars your federal government needs to take from you in order to keep those agencies afloat. Chuck, I think we've hit on the reason why we've got all of these and they don't combine and streamline and do it economically because they don't think they have to.
Well, that's right. There aren't enough ambassadorships to go around for big donors, so we've got to basically create agency positions to make people heads of. And in fact, if you recall, one of the big things that the Civil Service Act was supposed to fix was the idea of patronage.
Right.
Well, what it really did was allow entrenched civil servants who basically had an agenda to get into a job at certain levels. Now, sure, management changes in departments, but civil servants last through multiple administrations. And those people are all virtually impossible to get rid of because of the Civil Service Act. And what basically happens is these guys have political agendas. They sit in those jobs. They crank out rules year after year, decade after decade, sometimes 40 or 50 years in a single department, depending on when they start. And you simply can't get rid of them. So once the character of a department, like the State Department or the Justice Department, is set by appointments under the Civil Service Act, it's very difficult to change the direction of that department. Our State Department has been a hotbed of globalism attempting to surrender the sovereignty of the United States since the Roosevelt administration. So, you know, this is one of those things. We've gone far afield from our original intent to talk about these clauses, but the fact is it all ties in together.
It does, but the whole point is that the general basic idea is that our government officials, who are supposed to be responsible to we the people and are supposed to be limited and directed and hemmed in by the terms of the Constitution, are seeking more and more every day ways in which they can utilize people's lack of knowledge of this document in order to make claims for power and authority that our founders never intended for them to have. We see that in relation to the courts and dealing with the Obamacare issue. The courts, for the Supreme Court to say that you must go up through the district courts, That's not a power granted to them. For them to say, well, the supremacy clause means that the state it doesn't have any standing to sue, I'm sorry, that's a violation, especially when it's coming from a district or a circuit court who doesn't have the legitimate jurisdiction to be hearing the case in the first place, or if it comes from either the courts or the Congress utilizing these clauses as broad-based green lights for rapidly expanding, ever-expanding, unlimited authority over the people. That is not what our founders intended, and that's not what we should be allowing to have happen.
All right, I'm going to put in a plug in our last few seconds here.
Please.
I know right now you're teaching a class down in Gallipolis on the Institute on the Constitution, and it's really too late to sign up for that.
Right, we're going into our fourth week.
That's right. We would like to start a class in the Central Ohio area. If there are any of you out there that are interested, now I know there's a class starting up in the Canal Winchester area. I think they're talking about starting up after the first of the year. If there's anyone in the north, central, north, northeast, or even northwest side of Columbus, maybe Delaware, Worthington, Westerville, is interested in forming a class, I would like to teach a class after the first of the year. So please contact us here at the Institute for Principled Policy, and that's www.principledpolicy.com. And just drop us a line, go to the contact page, and send either me, Vice Chairman at principledpolicy.com, or Barry, Director at principledpolicy.com, an email, and let us know if you're interested in signing up for one of these classes that that we would like to be teaching starting after the first of the year. We will also run advertising. You know, we'll put up a little blog spot and say that we're looking for a location and we're looking for people who are interested in taking this class. If you want to know more about the Constitution and the Christian origins of our Constitution and the Christian origins of the founding of the United States of America, we invite you to take our Institute on the Constitution class. That's all we have for today. We would like you very much to tune in on Monday at 5:30 for our 15-minute show. We'll be here Monday through Friday next week, and then another hour again next Saturday. Thanks for being with us. We'll hope to see you next week.
Have a great weekend, folks.
After the ratification of the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson spoke out about the role of the states in protecting the people from federal government attacks on their liberties and their wallets. Here's what Jefferson said.
The states should be watchful to note every material usurpation on their rights, denounce them as they occur in the most peremptory terms, protest them as wrongs.
Jefferson is saying here that it's the duty of the states to keep the federal government in its place, that is, holding it to its limited role and its enumerated powers. Today, according to the Cato Institute, more than 90% of federal programs are against the law, including the bailing out of the banks and the taking over of the healthcare industry. But today, we see officials of state and local governments doing the exact opposite of their duty. Instead of being watchful and denouncing and protesting, for the most part, our state officials spend their time and energy acting as agents for the lawless actions of the federal government, effectively beating us down into submission instead of championing our rights. Well, this must stop. Maryland citizens should call on every elected official, starting with Governor Martin O'Malley, to declare, denounce, protest, and resist the lawless actions of Congress and the Obama administration. Governor O'Malley, Delegate Michael Bush, Senator Mike Miller, Chief Judge Robert Bell, Marylanders are asking you to uphold the law and protect us from federal tyranny. This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View. Recent news reports say that President Obama's health care plan will require citizens to purchase health insurance or else pay a fine. Does this sound bizarre to you? Michael Cannon, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, recently observed that the only way to avoid a health insurance mandate is by divesting yourself of a body. So this compulsory insurance is nothing less than the assumption that the government owns your body. Does this sound like slavery to you? Well, me too, and it raises other questions. Like, if we believe we have God-given rights, how can we expect a government that won't acknowledge that God exists to protect and defend rights that come from Him? And isn't it a little silly to hope that a government that steals from others to give some benefits to me won't steal from me too? And what should we do when government stops protecting the right to life and the right to property and actually becomes the most dangerous and despicable destroyer of these rights? Well, at the Institute on the Constitution, we study American history and the American principles of freedom. We strive to understand the concepts of self-government so that we have the tools we need to keep our government from becoming consolidated and corrupt. Do you feel you know everything you should know so that you could do your duty as a loyal American? Would you like to join us as a student of American thinking and American government? We are all about liberty and learning, and we invite you to join us. The website is iotconline.com, and the number is 866-730-9796. This is Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American View.